Putting on clothes, did you say?
Cologne.
Well, that is a very good question. The Isra of Losilbash, the Gemara says, does not only refer to clothing, but it refers to feminine mannerisms, such as removal of hair, dyeing of hair. One should not have gray hair, you want to look young. So the issue of cologne and perfume might fall within it. What you have, though, is you have a bit of a circular rule of Lysilbash, and that is when something becomes very common with men, even if the first people who did it were doing an Aveira, it no longer becomes Miyuchad Leisha. So if there are particularly men's colognes, and if you're in a community where people do wear cologne, and it's common, men wear colognes common, so even if they shouldn't have started it, it would not be Lysilbash. Now, the truth of the matter is, most yeshivish communities, cologne is taka not used, and then you could say it would be an issur of Lysilbash. But as I say, there is a catch 22. In fact, even with pants, you know, people make a big mistake. The issur of a woman wearing pants is not because of Lysilbash, because for keret, it is number one so common for women to wear pants in general society that it's not miyuchad liish. The only prohibition of pants is not because of Lysilbash, but it's because it accentuates the body, and therefore it's goreim more of a hirhor, a veira. So I would basically say, as long as you're in Yerushalayim, certainly don't wear cologne. When you're back in a place where it's common, it would be mutter. Okay? Yep. Anything?
Can you comment on the assimilation history of the Jewish people? We know that during the Hellenic, like the story of Hanukkah period,
yep,
there was a lot of the assimilation, but
yep,
I heard it really differs from the one that we are experiencing today in America. What are the differences, and is it, can we say that it was an upward trend since that time in terms of the Jews who assimilate?
Well, I would have to say that this is the worst that it has ever been, meaning to say we've had periods of assimilation, we've had periods of intermarriage, but I know Avigdor Miller writes that in spite of all of these bad times, it was only a minority of the Jewish people, that throughout the biblical period and afterwards, you did not have a majority of Jews who rejected the Torah. Today, if you look at it, what percentage of the Jewish world is Orthodox, is from, is Shomer Mitzvot? Again, I'm not talking about Yeshiva, Kollel, I'm talking about basic Shomer Shabbos. It's around 15 or 17%. That means you have 83 to 85% of the Jews do not believe in Torah Min HaShemayim. They do not believe in the 613 Mitzvot. That is very, very staggering. That's much worse than I think it has ever been. Am Yisrael has never been in the state that we're in. Now, the good news, if there's any good news, is that that's one of the reasons why the Chazon Ish says that a lot of the very harsh laws about apikorsim, that you kill an apikoris, you throw him into a pit, does not apply today, because when you live in a world where most of the Jewish people are technically Aprikorsim, we cannot fault them, we cannot stigmatize them, we cannot call them evil or Rishayim, simply because they're just following what everybody else is doing. It used to be an Aprikoris, you were rebelling against the Jewish people, you were deviating from the norm. This is exactly the opposite. The norm of Jewish life is to reject the Torah. So it's a very, very bad situation, and that's why one of the reasons why we say we're in the heels of Mashiach. Because when things get so bad, it's like Mitzrayim. Now perhaps this is the only parallel was Mitzrayim itself. When the Jewish people were in the 49th level of impurity, and 4/5 of the Jewish people died because they were not worthy of redemption. We hope that, God forbid, people shouldn't die because of this, but that would be the only time, I think, in our history that was like today. No, so it is a very, very serious issue. In fact, that's even the justification people say. People say, why does everybody have to go to Kollel and everyone goes to Yeshiva? Why don't we encourage people to work? There's legitimate arguments here. But you have to take things in perspective. Why does everybody go to Kollel? I mean, it's not everybody goes to Kollel. You're dealing with 85% of the Jewish people are not Shomer Shabbos. They don't accept the Torah. So you're dealing with a small minority within Orthodoxy, which is a tiny minority to begin with. So the argument is that when the assimilation is very, very powerful, then those who have not succumbed, they have to be extra strong and extra strict, and they have to go to the other extreme, which normally might not have been the best way. But that's just to prevent the whole nation from falling over the cliff. Right? If someone is on the verge of falling over a cliff, I have to step back further and further and further just to prevent them from falling over the cliff. So that would even be a reason for what some people might criticize as the extremism of the Haredi world, because the truth of the matter is we have an extremism in the other direction that we have to be able to combat. So it's a very, very disturbing situation. That's just Hashem. We should be zeichet to Mashiach. We're thinking about, we're approaching the 3 weeks. We think about the Chorban and the Golas, and we hope that through our tefillas and our tshuva and our ma'asim tovim, we should be zeichet to a geula shleima. Okay.
What's the whole Indian of the Erim in order that we need Erim in order to be mekadosh on the new month? If the Chachamim actually knew when Rosh Chodesh was, the whole concept behind it.
Yeah, this is a big, big, huge machlokas between Rav Sadia Gaon and the Rambam. The simple pshat of the Gemara and the Mishnayos is very, very simple. That is, even though the Sanhedrin knew with calculations when Rosh Chodesh was supposed to be, there is a mitzvah to sanctify when you have a Sanhedrin, there's a mitzvah to sanctify the new moon by Kabbalah Eidos, by having visual Eidos, and then sending shluchim around. And that is why in Chutz La'aretz they had to keep 2 days of Yom Tov, because Rosh Chodesh could be either day 30 or day 31. And in Eretz Yisrael they would know by the time the Yom Tov came around which day was Rosh Chodesh. In Chutz La'aretz they wouldn't, and they'd have to have 2 days. Now what happened is that when you don't have a Sanhedrin, you cannot do that. So the last Sanhedrin calculated the Rosh Chodeshim and they determined them in advance. They sanctified them, which means, according to the Rambam Shita, the reason why we have Yom Tov today is not because of the calendar. It's because the Sanhedrin was actually Mekadesh. They made like thousands of dates, and they were Mekadesh each date ahead of time until the year 6000. And according to the Rambam, if God forbid Mashiach doesn't come by the year 6000, there will not be Yomim Tovim anymore. Because Yom Tov, according to the Rambam, is not based on astronomy. It is based on Kiddush Beis Din, which, however, could have been done in advance. They did it many years in advance. And since they were batuach that Mashiach would come by the year 6000 and will go back to the old system, they were not Mekadesh after the year 5999. That means that when 5,999 ends, you will not have a Rosh Hashanah, you will not have a Yom Kippur, you will not have a Sukkot, you will not have a Pesach, unless of course Mashiach comes, and we are mamin that Mashiach will come. So according to the Rambam, the Iker Kiddush HaChodesh has to be through witnesses, and that is really Merumas in HaKadosh Baruch Hu saying to Moshe V'Aaron, HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem. This month is to be determined by you, and you is Moshe and Aaron are two witnesses. They're two brothers. And even though they're brothers, the Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah says you can have Krovim. Krovim are kosher for the Eidus HaChodesh. Rav Sadia Gaon, who was a little earlier than the Rambam, did argue with this position. Rav Sadia Gaon basically said that the Iker Mitzvah of Kiddush HaChodesh is astronomical computation, and the Eidim were just a way of publicizing to the people that it was Rosh Chodesh because people saw it, etc. But mainstream halacha follows the Rambam's view that Kiddush al pi Re'iyah, sanctification through visual testimony, is required. Now, you do have to understand, though, that this was not an absolute rule, because according to the Mishnah, if the Sanhedrin thought the witnesses were lying, and the witnesses said they saw the moon when they didn't, the Sanhedrin still had the backup authority to make another day Rosh Chodesh. So, even like the Rambam, Kiddush al pi Re'iyah is in the nature of a lechatchila, not a bidiyevet. Meaning, lechatchila, this is the procedure. Bidiyevet, the Sanhedrin is koveya, what the cheshbon is.
So what we're doing around is a bidiyevet.
So we're doing bidiyevet. Obviously, everything we do is bidiyevet. Well, no. The way the Rambam explains it, we're still doing it lechatchila because the last Sanhedrin calculated. See what I'm saying? The last Sanhedrin calculated all the Rosh Chodeshim in advance, and they sanctified them. So we're actually doing it lechatchila because we're not sanctifying the new moon. These new moons were already sanctified. You see, when I said it's bidiyevet, I would have meant that when you had a Sanhedrin and they didn't use witnesses, bidiyevet, the moon would be sanctified. But the way you said it is correct because I was confusing two things for a moment. We have Rosh Chodesh because of the Sanhedrin. But you are correct. Obviously, when the Sanhedrin sanctified Rosh Chodesh 2,000 years in advance, they were not doing it through witnesses. Right. So you are correct. We are operating bidiyevet in the sense that we do have the sanctification of a Sanhedrin, but they did not do so through witness testimony. But the point I'm making is, had they not sanctified it, according to the Rambam, it wouldn't be kadosh even bidiyevet. So this way, at least we have bidiyevet. Okay? In other words, there are two concepts that are overlapping but distinct. One is the requirement that Rosh Chodesh be sanctified by a Sanhedrin. The other is the Sanhedrin should act through witnesses. Now, in the Jewish calendar, we do believe the sanctification of Rosh Chodesh was done by the Sanhedrin. But since they were doing so in advance, they didn't have witnesses, they were using mathematical calculation. However, mathematical calculation by itself is not valid even with the Evid. You needed the Kiddush of that last Sanhedrin. According to Rav Sadia Gaon, however, the mathematical calculation would have been enough.
So, according to Rav Sadia Gaon, you would be in the event that Chas v'Shalom Mashiach doesn't come by 6,000.
We'll just continue the calendar. That's right. That's exactly right. Because according to Rav Sadia Gaon, what makes Rosh Chodesh is in fact the cheshbon of Rosh Chodesh. According to the Rambam, what makes Rosh Chodesh is the kiddush of Beis Din, of a Sanhedrin. And you can't have that kiddush unless you have a Sanhedrin, and you cannot have a Sanhedrin. Now again, it's important to know, the Sanhedrin does not require a Beis HaMikdash. And in fact, they continue to sanctify Rosh Chodesh even after the Churban. You don't need a Beis HaMikdash for Kiddush HaChodesh. What you need, however, is Semicha. Semicha is unbroken ordination going back from Moshe Rabbeinu. And we're going to get that back when Eliyahu HaNavi comes, because he had Semicha and he can give it to Talmidei Chachamim. But people make a mistake. It is not the Beis HaMikdash that is needed. It is Semicha that is needed. And we do not have Semicha Bizman Hazeh, because we don't have anybody that has an unbroken ordination going back from Moshe Rabbeinu.
Until when?
So Semicha existed, they say, really, until the time of the Amoraim. They say Abaye and Rava were the last ones, or perhaps right before them. And the reason basically is that the Romans, various other nations, just killed the last rabbis that had it, and they before they were able to pass it on. And that's so significant. Although every rabbi has something called smicha, right? But all of us have fake smicha. We don't have real smicha. Don't tell anybody. Because smicha that a person gets today is simply authorization from his rebbe or from his yeshiva that he's capable of paskening certain matters of Jewish law. And there are different types of smichas. Sometimes now they've invented limited purpose smichas. You know, you can get a smicha in Hilchos Shabbos only, or a smicha in Isser V'Heter, Hilchos Kashrus, or the highest smicha is in Cheshen Mishpat as well. You could be a Dayan. I think I had mentioned that in the time of the Gemara, the highest smicha was to Matir B'chor. You could say if a firstborn animal had a mum, that was considered to be the highest level. But all of that is really in the nature of a diploma, the nature of a certificate. But the smicha that allows you to function with the Sanhedrin, dinei nefashas, to div malchus, all these different things, kenosais, which no basin can do today. No basin could. If you steal something, a basin might order you to be able to pay it back, but they cannot order you to pay kefil. So all of those things require smuchim, real smicha, and we do not have real smicha today because that lapsed. Now you may recall, you may have read that in the time of the Beis Yosef, Rav Yosef Cairo's Rebbe, Rav Yaakov Beirab, had an unusual shita based on the Rambam, that if most of the Chachamim of the generation agree to recreate smicha, they could create it out of nothing and they could ordain people. That you don't need an unbroken line. And he tried to actually do that. He tried to get the Chachamim to agree, and he actually gave what he thought was real smicha to four people. Among them Rav Yosef Cairo himself, Rav Moshe Alshich, they're all in Tzfat, Rav Moshe Alshich, Rav Moshe Galanti, and the Mabit, Rav Moshe Ben Yosef Trani, the Mabit. But because there was a great Machar, people didn't agree, so it didn't get continued. But most poskim say that smicha requires an unbroken line, and you just can't recreate it, yesh me'ayin, because of the Chachamim. But if we had smichas, a lot of things we could do. If we had a Sanhedrin, there are many things we could do. We could make new takanos, new gezeros. We could repeal some takanos. Some people have suggested that when there's a Sanhedrin, they would abolish the need for a second day of Yom Tov in Chutz La'aretz for a very good reason. Because why do we have 2 days of Yom Tov? The Gemara itself asked the Kasha. Why do I have 2 days of Yom Tov? Because of a suffix. But today we have a fixed calendar. So we know when Rosh Chodesh is, in America too. So why have 2 days? So the Gemara's answer is, because when the Beis HaMikdash is rebuilt, we'll go back to the old system of witnesses. But here's the kasha. Even if we go back to the old system of witnesses, ain't a chinami. But we're not going to need Pony Express to tell people. If we have the old system of witnesses, we'll have email and everything else. So there'll still be instantaneous communication, except for Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah, we can't do that, but you know, before Pesach, we'll notify everybody. So the answer is, well, the Sanhedrin enacted this takana, we can't repeal it. But if we had a new Sanhedrin, they could actually say, for example, I'm just giving an example, that in light of communication innovations, there would be no need to keep 2 days of Yom Tov in Chutz La'aretz, because even when we go back to the old system of witnesses, there will be instantaneous transmission. Of course, it would have to be an encrypted email. This is actually a problem with our friends across the street. They're in Ramadan right now. And Ramadan, you know, the Islamic calendar is a lunar calendar like the Jewish calendar. It's based on the moon, but it's even more lunar than the Jewish calendar, because we have, you know, Adar Sheni, so that Pesach will be in the spring. Their Ramadan could be any time of year. Right, so 30 days of fasting from morning until a night, and then they have parties all night, etc. So they determine new moon based on witnesses. They still have some ceremony where somebody testifies. I don't know where they testify, but and they send out emails telling people when Rosh Chodesh is, Lahavdil, and apparently people mess up. People send false messages and the like, just like the Gemara says, right? The Gemara says that we used to have bonfires. The Sanhedrin would have bonfires on different mountaintops to spread when Rosh Chodesh was, but the Tzdukim would try to mess up by having competing bonfires, so people would get mixed up, and that's why they were misaken to have shluchim, you know, validated, authorized messengers of the Sanhedrin that would travel around. So if we do go to email, we would have to be sure that it's encrypted and have security features and everything else, but logically there would be no need for 2 days of Yom Tov based on that.
I heard somewhere that there's an opinion which holds that when the Mashiach comes, Korach will be the Kohen Gadol.
Yeah, this is the Arizal brings. The Korach will be the Kohen Gadol. In fact, it's interesting, now the Sfas Emes says a whole interesting thing from the Chiddushei Harim. This is a little off your topic, but I'll come back to it. That is, Korach was destined to have a position called Levi Gadol. Very, very fascinating. Just as there is a Kohen and there's the head Kohen, there was supposed to be a position called the head Levi. And Korach was destined to be Levi Gadol. Now, Levi Gadol doesn't mean the Nasi of the tribe of Levi, because that in fact is an assigned position. That was given to Elazar. In fact, that the Nasi of Shevet Levi is actually a Kohen. That's Elazar ben Aaron. So one of the Kohanim became the Nasi of the Levi. But within Levium, who were not Kohanim, Korach was supposed to be the Levi Gadol, and because of his gaiva, he became disqualified, and the office was abolished. It's interesting. There is no position of Levi Gadol. But the Arizal does bring down that Korach will either, there are two Gersois, either become Kohen Gadol. Now how that happens is a bit of a mystery, because Korach is not a Kohen, or some interpret it to mean he will be restored to the position of Levi Gadol. You know, Korach is a very tragic figure. I talked about this Friday night. The Emes says Korach had tremendous, tremendous greatness. And there's a certain law in Ruchnius you might call conservation of spiritual energy, that God does not want things to go to waste. And if people have tremendous powers, there will be a way that those powers will be redeemed if there is a tshuva and the like. Now, this raises a very difficult question. Can a person do tshuva after his death? It's very difficult. It is clear that Korach, to this very day, is experiencing regret for his sins. The Gemara in Bava Basra describes Korach as like meat in a barbecue that's being turned over a fire. And Korach proclaims from under the ground, Moshe emes v'toyraso emes. Moshe is true and his Torah is true. The anachnu badoyim, and we are liars. We are people who make things up. So that sounds like tshuva. On the other hand, can a person do tshuva in Gehenna? On the other hand, there is also a principle that a person's children and descendants can raise a person out of Gehenna. Korach had righteous children who are the Mishayrim, or who were the Mishayrim, the singers in the Beis HaMikdash, and Korach also had Shmuel HaNavi. In fact, even the Rasha, Elisha ben Avuya is a Tana, or was a Tana, and he became a heretic. But Rabbi Meir continued to learn from Elisha ben Avuya. And when people ask Rabbi Meir, how can you learn from an apikoros? Rabbi Meir's famous answer was that this is like a pomegranate that has an inedible peel and edible seeds. I throw away the bad peel, the bad stuff that he says, and I only eat the good seeds. People use this argument sometimes for university. People want to take courses in Jewish studies, because if you've been in yeshiva, you figure, oh, that's going to be easy. They'll talk about a little bit of Gemara superficially. That'll be, you know, really, really easy. But the Jewish studies courses have the most kfira in them, because Jewish studies courses will often, I'm not saying every single course, will often deny the divinity of the Torah, will talk about the rabbis making things up without a Masorah, etc. So they're actually the worst courses for a firm person to take. But people say, well, Rav Meir learned from Acher, so I can learn from Apikoros. I'll take the good stuff, and I won't accept the bad stuff. But the short answer is that when you're Rabbi Meir, you can learn from Acher. But if you're not Rabbi Meir, you can't learn from Acher, because in fact, there's a great, great danger in all of this. But yet, notwithstanding that fact, the Gemara in Chagiga and the Medrash tells us that Rabbi Meir brought Acher out of Gehenna as well. That he was able to bring Acher out of Gehenna, and Acher also has a some chelik in Olam Haba as a result. So Korach will be the same situation.
Why Korach and not Aaron?
So really, it depends how you understand it. Meaning to say, if Korach is Levi Gadol rather than Kohen Gadol, so that's fine. Aaron is Kohen Gadol. It seems to be. It seems like this. We don't really understand how things are going to work. Lasid Lava, but it seems to be that Aaron will be the Kohen Gadol. As Aaron will go into the Kodesh HaKodashim on Yom Kippur. Kohen Gadol in connection of Korach does not mean the actual Kohen Gadol, but it means like the senior Kohen, meaning to say he'll be the, just like in the American Army, I don't know if in the British Army it's this way, you know, you have officers, but then there's actually a rank called the highest non-commissioned officer, meaning to say people, you're not an officer, but you're the highest person of someone that's not an officer, and that gufa is an office, strangely enough. So Korach will not be the Kohen Gadol, but he will be the highest non-Kohen Gadol, the highest of the Kohanim and the Levim. Yeah?
How should a person evaluate how to balance learning Be'in and learning Akias, like post-Yeshiva life?
You know, that's a really, really difficult, hard question, because I honestly don't think you can give a good answer. Because it depends on every individual person. I do think the following. You know, what we say in yeshiva is that the goal of yeshiva is to teach you how to learn. So the question is, we spend so many years teaching you how to learn, so the question is, when do you learn? Meaning to say, a person can spend so many years and only know a few, not even know, but have learned a few pages here, a few pages here. There are going to be whole areas of the Torah that a person is never going to cover, whether it's Kodshim, whether it's Taros, whether it's Zerayim. I'm not even talking about esoterica like the Yerushalmi. We'll put that aside, that most people may not get there. But even basic, you know, parts of the Gemara, parts of the Mishnayos, and the like. So the emes is that what is recommended by many, many people, including Rav Shach, including the greatest Rosh Hashivas, is that you don't create this dichotomy, in fact, even in yeshiva, and kal v'chomer outside of yeshiva, you don't create the dichotomy between extreme iyun and then superficial bekiyas. Because, in a way, both of those extremes are going to shortchange you. The extreme iyun is going to shortchange you because you're going to cover so little. And if you really don't have a lot of gemara under your belt, the iyun doesn't work very well either. Bekiyas, if it's superficial, you don't remember it, so even if you learned 200 blocks, if it doesn't stay in your head, what do you have? Rather, what Rav Shach used to emphasize was, he thought there ought to be one way of learning, and that one way of learning is basically a very thorough learning of Pshat, meaning to say, you don't overdo things by looking up many, many different svarim, but rather you try to learn well so you understand what you're learning. And you look up things not for the sake of looking them up. The truth is, that's not even Ian. That's Bekiyas and Mefarshim. That's not. Rather, you learn to understand Gemara, Rashi, and Tosos. Now, when you learn to understand Gemara, Rashi, and Tosos, you will have kashas. They will be your kashas. They're not going to be superimposed things that you look at. You're learning and you're thinking. You have kashas. When you have kashas, you then look around different sources to try to see approaches that will help you with your kashas. In other words, your eon is not simply to look at things. Your eon is to deal with questions that you have. So I would say, especially when you leave yeshiva and your time is much more limited, your goal should be to learn Gemara, Rashi, and Tosfos with basic pshat. Basic pshat. But not superficial pshat. Basic pshat. And when you need to look up something, you look it up. But your basic goal is to learn pshat in Gemara Rashi. Do you see what I'm saying? In other words, it's not a question of Iyun versus Bekiyas. It's a question of pshat. I want to know what I'm learning. I want to understand what I'm learning. And I'll take the time. I'll take the time. I'm not going to rush through things. But I'm only doing it to understand what I'm learning. I'm not doing it to look up a whole bunch of things. Now, having said that, it is recommended if for no other reason than to give you a great geschmack in learning, that maybe once a week, or even once a month, you take one of the sugyas that you've learned in Pshat, and your ma'ayin, Rebbe Kiva Eger, Ketzos HaChoshen, Minchas Chinuch, and that way you selectively do something bi'iyun, but you don't spend a lot of time. Maybe you spend 1 day or 2 days on it. Your main learning is Pshat. No, I'll give you an example. Even a gadol like Rebbe Yashiv learned that way. Rebbe Yashiv's favorite, Rebbe Yashiv was never in yeshiva, but because he was so connected to B'nai Torah, he followed the yeshiva schedule, meaning he had a Bein Hazmanim. What does Rebbe Yashiv do Bein Hazmanim? What do you mean he had a Bein Hazmanim? His Bein Hazmanim was that he would learn Mishnah L'Melech. In other words, I guess, during the Zman, he Beikar learned Gemara, Rashi, and Taisus. If you ever see a picture of him, you don't. Although, obviously, I don't know when he learned it, because all the pictures of him learning is always with a Gemara. You know, you don't see him looking up this Sefer, that Sefer. On the other hand, he knew all those things, so he must have seen it sometime. But his learning was Gemara. So what did he do Bein Hazmanim? He would learn the Mishnah Melech. I don't know if you've ever learned the Mishnah. Mishnah Melech is a perush on the Rambam. But it's a very involved, it's pilpul, very, very, you know, complicated and deep and intricate. And he loved it. This was like candy for him, to go through a complicated, you know, mind-blowing Mishnah Melech. But he considered that a vacation, because he says the Iker learning is Pshat in Gemara, Rashi, and Taisus, as a special treat to himself. Alvai, we should have those recreations. As a special treat to himself, he would do Mishnah L'Melech. I think that is helpful for most of us as well. Your diet, now I don't want to compare, I don't want to, God forbid, say that learning Pilpul Svarim is like eating candy. But in a sense it is, that it should be a treat. It should not be the main diet. The main diet has to be Gemara, Rashi, and Taisus. So I'm not sure if I answered your question, but based on what Rav Shach said, he felt that we shouldn't have such a sharp dichotomy between like extreme Ian and then extreme Bekias. Things should kind of be in the middle. And he coupled it with a lot of Chazara. Chazara is by far the Iker should be Ikram. Because the truth is, if you have Chazara, in a way, no matter how you learn, you're gonna do okay, because Chazara is the Iker way that we remember what we learn. Otherwise, we don't have anything.
And yep. Slightly related to that, in terms of, I know it kind of depends on your ability, but in terms of like using tools to get that shot versus like expending your own effort, and then in particular,
Art Scroller, whatever.
Why does it seem like the Masifta is like more accepted than the Art Scroller?
Well, are you comparing the English Art Scroll with the Masifta, or even the Hebrew Art Scroll?
I guess the Hebrew is a stronger copy.
Yeah, okay. In other words, you think that the Masifta is accepted more than the Hebrew Art Scroll? I don't know. I haven't done a controlled experiment. Yeah. I will tell you that this is a phenomenally good picture for advertising purposes. Art Scroll got a picture of Rebbe Yashiv looking at the Hebrew Art Scroll. So, that's going to give him like $1 million of sales. But the thing is, I don't know how Rebbe Yashiv got a share of the whatever. But the thing is that, let me say a few things. When you're in yeshiva and you're learning how to make a laning, you're learning how to learn Gemara by yourself, so we discourage a little bit. I love the art school. I mean, I use it myself sometimes when no one's around. But but you do understand that it is a crutch. It is a help, like all help. It's a crutch. And if you want to learn how to learn yourself, how to make a laning, so you need to develop both the vocabulary and understanding how to read Rashi and Tosos. Hopefully, learn Rishonim. So you can understand why, or I can understand why, in a yeshiva setting, we want to discourage people from using Art Scroll, because otherwise a person will never acquire the talents. It's like if somebody had a chauffeur that drove them around all the time, and you know they may never learn to walk. You know, they say the story about a chauffeur carrying a 45-year-old man out of a car, and his mother comes out, and somebody says, "Why is your son being carried?" He says, "Well, why does he have to walk? He has a chauffeur." You know, obviously, though, we don't want that. Now, The question is, though, once you have the skill, once I know how to make a laning, once I know how to do it, but I have problems sometimes, and I just want to see what Art Scroll says, there's really nothing wrong with it, and it could be very helpful. And I don't think there's an automatic chiluk between the Hebrew and the Hebrew and the English. The only thing is that we know that in learning Torah, amelus b'Torah is very, very important. Working in Torah is very important. So here is the thing. If you use a shortcut, it shouldn't be a substitute for amelus. It should enable you to do your amelus on a higher level. You see, so for example, let's say I don't know what a word means. So I could be amel in looking up dictionaries, I could be an amel in trying to figure it out. But if I do Art Scroll, I eliminate the need to work for that. But that frees me up. That instead of spending a half an hour or 45 minutes working out the meaning of a word, I can spend a half an hour or 45 minutes understanding Tosus Svara. So if you're using Art Scroll not to end your Yigia, but to put the Yigia HaTorah on a higher level, then goes into, hey, why should I spend 45 minutes? Now again, I'm talking about someone who already knows. I mean, to make a laning, you need to spend that. But if we're talking about someone who basically knows, but he occasionally has a problem, why should I spend 45 minutes on a word if I could spend 45 minutes thinking about the Tosos? But if you're using Art Scroll to curtail your Yigia, in other words, oh, I got the word, so now that's fine, I'll just read it and then go to sleep or stop learning, then it becomes destructive because it takes away Yigia b'Torah. Okay, so that I think is the chiluk. There's nothing wrong with shortcuts if it enables you to pursue your Yigia on a higher level. Now, why is Masifta more favored? I think because Masifta is a harder, it does take more Yigia. Masifta gathers together many, many Svarim, but it's still quite difficult. I mean, if I'm reading an essay in Masifta, right, so I still have to digest Rebbe Akiva Eiger and the Ketzos and many, many Mefarshim. Just because they put it together in one book, so I don't have to have 20 Svarim, the Yigia, I think, is still there. So I think the very fact that Masifta is written on a higher level than Art Scroll, in a sense, you still have that Yigia factor. But some people are against Masifta too. I don't be Spanish. We have Masifta. We don't have Art Scroll. Maybe that's your raya.
Yeah.
But I think that would be the difference. Yeah. Yeah.
I have a question. I got a question about this new urban farming techniques in Israel. Like they're growing, like basically created like soil tops and on rooftops. They're growing
on roofs. Yeah.
Now, how is that in terms of Shemitah? Is that okay? Is that not okay?
It's not going to be okay. I'll tell you why. Because we do have this din that although things in flower pots might not be subject to Shemitah, but things on building tops are, and the reason is because we consider a building as connected to the ground. And the rule is anything connected to the ground is halachically the same as the ground. So the dirt that's on top of a roof is considered to be connected indirectly to the primary grounds below. So all the laws of Shemitah and Truma and Maser are going to apply. Now, if it's in a flower pot, then it actually depends. Some apply that even to flower pots if it's made of earthenware, because we treat earthenware as porous, and therefore it's considered to be connected to the underlying ground. According to that, by the way, if you move a flower pot on Shabbos, you're guilty of harvesting because you're uprooting it. Others say that if the flower pot is metal or plastic, you don't have a problem. But that's a flower pot. But when you simply have dirt on a stone roof without a hefsek of plastic between the dirt and the stones, that is considered to be connected to the karka. So that's
but
not
good. You can have a separation?
Yeah. So if you put... The simple etza would be that if you have a separation of plastic or a rug or something of that nature, or a mat, plastic mat...
Then that's not natural material.
That's correct. That's correct. If it's natural material, it would not be good. But if it's plastic or metal... Well, metal is natural, but it's not an organic material. That would be all right. That would be sufficient to get you out of the Shemitah problems. That's right, yeah.
What's the shot at today with strawberries? You're not allowed to eat strawberries on stage, you're not allowed to eat legumes, and you have to work with salt water.
Well,
4 years ago, it wasn't the king of 5 years ago, and before it, everybody had strawberries without problems. So.
Well, you know, it depends who you ask. Meaning, we know what the issur is. The issur is eating the insects that may be in fruit. And over the years, people have developed various methods to try to remove insect infestation. Some claim that the methods are not totally effective. The American Rabbanim tend to be more lenient than the Rabbanim in Eretz Yisrael. Now, it may be because there's more infestation in Eretz Yisrael, because they use less pesticides. So as a result, organic fruit, for example, has greater levels. But I personally rely on the soapy water. You should cut out the one thing, you should cut off the tops of the strawberries, because the insects are most concentrated. You know, on the top of a strawberry, you have some leaves. So that's the part where it's very hard to see them, because even some of the black spots might be little insects. So you cut off the top, and then agitate it in some soapy water, and then you rinse it out. May not be worth the trouble at that point. You may say, oh, I don't eat strawberries, but and then I would say you could eat them. But again, some people are machmer. All I'm telling you is that some people are very, very machmer on these inyanim. They don't rely on any of these cleaning tests. But I think you could be sadekah. But just be sure to cut off the top. That's really the most important thing. This issue, by the way, you know, there is a principle in halacha that any type of insect that is not visible to the naked eye is not prohibited. Because the truth is, every time we open our mouths, we're taking in little organisms that are not kosher. But if you cannot see it, the Torah doesn't answer. However, what's important to know is the definition of not seeing it means it's invisible. If you see a little dot, but you cannot tell if it's an insect or not, that is still treated as something visible. Visible literally means invisible. So consequently, these little spots, which you cannot tell if they're insects or not, there you have to be machmer. By the way, there's a similar problem even with orange peel. You have to be very, 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 very careful. You know, take an orange. Now, Baruch Hashem, oranges themselves are not insect infested. I mean, oranges you can eat. But you'll notice on orange peels, black spots, very common. In many cases, those black spots are insects. They are insects. They are not, thorn scratches or whatever it is. And as a result, if you like to chew on orange peels, some people like to chew on orange peels, some have chocolate-covered orange peels. If it's not under a hashgacha, like a Eda Charej or something, you should not eat orange peels unless you have an area that clearly does not have any spot. You have to visually inspect it. This was even a big issue with the Tropicana oranges. I don't know if you heard of it. Again, they're still checking into this. Because some orange juice manufacturers, they kind of crush the whole orange, so part of the peel, that's not pulp, but part of the peel somehow gets in or whatever it is, and then they sift the peel out, but some of the insects may remain in. And there was actually some concern that in Tropicana orange juice, they're called scale insects. These black scale insects were in the Tropicana oranges, and it's virtually microscopic, but not 100%. So it would be microscopic, it wouldn't be a shiloh. So the different vatim have permitted it. But this is an issue. Certainly when you're eating a peel, you have to be aware of it. It would be batel b'shishim, but our problem is if it's a whole insect, it's not batel, because it's called a beria and it's not batel. Now, the part of the heter was that, okay, maybe it's a beria, but if the peel got crushed, you can assume the insect got crushed, and therefore it would be batel b'shishim at that point.
With broccoli, there seems to be also the same issue. But even it goes even further, even beyond that, because as mashgiach, as I worked in America, the way they taught you, the teacher is that you boil it, you put in boiling water, and then warm water, and then you shake them, and then
what thing are you talking about? For what?
For broccoli.
For broccoli, yes.
Yeah, if you shake it and it doesn't have any bugs, You can therefore assume, well, after you check it, and you can therefore assume that there's no bugs.
Yep.
But ultimately, it says that they teach you that ultimately there's no way that you can possibly clean broccoli. So it's like, what's the approach to understanding such as Sfara? I mean, when it comes to such a, like you know, a lab midoraita?
Yes. There is certainly technically a very serious prohibition, but part of it goes with what you might call a double doubt. The double doubt is, first of all, after I check, maybe there are no bugs. Even if there are bugs, in the process of cooking, the bug might have fallen apart. And if it falls apart, it'll be batel in 60. A whole bug is not batel b'shishim. But if it's nimuach, if it dissolves, it is batel b'shishim. Now, you don't know. Maybe there's a whole bug that didn't get dissolved, right? But that's called a double doubt, meaning I could eat broccoli after bedika based on the idea that maybe there's no bugs. And even if there's a bug, maybe it's nimuach and batel b'shishim. Right, so that would be the basis of it, of being meka once you've done bedika. Okay. Where did you work as a mashgiach?
In South Florida.
Ah, very good. For?
For the Orbi.
Very good. All right, Baruch Hashem. So you have a lot of experience in the practical problems. Yeah. You know, I don't know if you know Rav Barrow Wine. He's a very, very prominent Rav. He sometimes gives shiurim here. He was actually the head of the OU. He had many, many positions. He was Rosh Shiva and Rav and head of the OU. Once you work in Hashgacha, it's very hard for you to eat anything because you see all of the problems, all of the shilas, and it's very it's disheartening. But on the other hand, the Torah was not given, Chazal say, to angels, and we do the best that we can. And if we do the best that we can, and then Chas v'Shalom, a mistake is made, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, forgives us because we are relying on the tests that we have to determine this. Okay, anything else? Yeah?
There seems to be quite a controversy between what the Yamagadol is in the Gemara. Some say it's the Mediterranean, some say it's
the Atlantic.
The Atlantic, whatever ocean it is.
Yeah.
What is really, is it considered as a machlokes, or is there actual conclusion?
Well, it is a machlokes, but overwhelmingly, we assume it's the Mediterranean. That is called the Yamagadol. Now, there is a machlokes, because remember, the Torah says that the western boundary of Eretz Yisrael is the Yam HaGadol. So if it's the Mediterranean, that's quite logical, right? The western coast of Eretz Yisrael is along the shores of the Mediterranean, right? That's exactly what it is. If, however, the opinion that says the Atlantic is quite interesting, because they draw two parallel lines from the north and the south of Israel, and they draw it all the way to America, perhaps even beyond, perhaps even in a circle, and everything between those two lines are within the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael. So what part of America would that give you? In other words, if you drew two parallel lines from the north and southern boundaries of Eretz Yisrael, by the way, which would be further north anyway, further north to the Euphrates and to the Nile, how much of America would be within Eretz Yisrael? Quite a lot. I think you wouldn't get New York. You wouldn't get New York. So New York would be outside. But you would get everything from around Maryland to Florida. Plus all of the, right? So that's an amazing thing. But La Halacha, we don't paskin that way. La Halacha, we paskin that Yama Gadol is Mediterranean. And that's what that's what Rashi says. That's what most poskim say. Yeah.
We just read in the Mishnah and Brachos that you can't pray for a past event, something that already happened. And we didn't see the Gemara, we didn't really discuss it, but I'm wondering, what if there's a situation where there is a metzius, something actually happened, but no one knows what happened? For instance, you take an exam, you pass it in, your answers are right or wrong, but no one's graded it, no one knows your grade, you don't know anything. Can you pray?
Well, I think you'll see from the Gemara that is called a past event, even if nobody knows it, because the Gemara talks about pregnancies. To pray, right, it says that how could Leah pray that the boy that she was carrying, that the child she was carrying should turn into a girl. Right? And now the Gemara's maskana is she could, but the Gemara held that normally you could not do that. Now you cannot, a woman cannot pray once she's pregnant that this should be a boy or a girl, because that's already determined. So that's mashma, that is mashma, maybe the first 40 days. The Gemara gives two terutzim. The Gemara asks the Kasha, how could Leah pray? So one answer is, within 40 days, things could change. And the other answer is, it was a special nace for the Mahos, and it's not a riot to anybody else. But the bottom line is, if a woman is 3 months pregnant, and she doesn't know, and she wants to pray to have it be a boy or a girl, that's called a tefillah shav, even though nobody knows yet, right? So that's a riot to them. However, in your case of the test, I would suggest that tefillah does work, because different things could happen. Your answers can't change, but maybe the teacher will decide to throw away the test, or maybe the teacher will decide to give you extra credit for class participation. So there are still a fanim in which you can pray to Hashem, may I emerge from this in a good way. So you can't say, if my answers were wrong, let them turn right. But you could be mispalel in another
Wouldn't
way.
That be praying for a miracle, though?
Well, no, because the miracle would be if your answers would change.
Right.
But if the miracle would be, we'll cancel the test, or we'll give you extra credit for class participation, that's not a miracle. That's a very fortunate event, but I wouldn't call it an absolute supernatural miracle. Yeah, okay. Okay, my question.
Any other president, the one who corrects or He'll
yep.
have mercy on you, and you will, like, I don't oversee a mistake, or I don't know, see something. Like,
well, to pray, okay, all right. Are you allowed to pray that the marker should cheat? That I don't know. Maybe, you know.
Yeah.
Pray that I can bribe him. Yeah, that already maybe that's not a proper tefillah, but that may work as well. In fact, there's a very fascinating tshuva of the Chassam Sofer. It's very, very relevant. If I'll end here. A Jew was taken by the authorities and sentenced to death. So are you allowed to bribe the judge to get him out? Because here is the Shaila. B'nai Noach are commanded to execute justice. I'm not allowed to bribe a Noachai judge to pervert justice, because I'm Iver and Lifnei Iver. I'm causing him to transgress his responsibility. And therefore it is forbidden normally for a Jew to bribe certainly a non-Jewish judge, maybe even a non-Jewish government official. But the Chassam Sofer says, since a non-Jewish court does not have the right to sentence Jews to death, so consequently a bribery would not be a violation of dinim, because it is not within their authorization to impose such a dinim. Okay, so there would be a difference. You could not bribe a non-Jewish judge to release a non-Jewish convict, unless the trial was corrupt. But if the trial was a just trial, you would not be allowed to bribe the non-Jewish judge. But the Chassam Sofer said you could bribe him for a Jewish person. So, all right, that's okay. All right, we'll stop here. Have a good week.